MacCast, Sunday, February 26th, 2012. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. I have a great show for you today. We got lots of good stuff to talk about. Of course, there's the general smattering of rumors and some good news to get to, but in the back half of the show, I have a great interview for you and a dive into something that we all have on our Macs, very few of us use, but maybe more of us should use. And I've talked about it before on the show, and that is Automator. Automator is a great, powerful tool that's built into the Mac, but it's a little bit of a mystery to most of us, myself included. And so I dabble around with it, and I play with it, and I've done some things with it. But every time I get in and use it, it just blows me away the amount of power that is under the hood there. And I invited somebody who knows a lot more about the subject than I do, actually somebody I've turned to a couple times to help me out with Automator stuff. I met him at Macworld a few years ago. His name is Ben Waldie, literally wrote the book on Automator for Peach Pit and has a site, automatedworkflows.com, and does a lot with Automator. Just released some add-ons in the Mac App Store, additional actions, as you'll find out they're called, to use in Automator. And it was great fun to get him on, and I learned a lot, and I'm happy to be able to share that with you on this episode. So we probably should just dive in, get to everything that we need to get to. Before I get started, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show's sponsors. And this month, Audible is back. If you've never tried out Audible, now is a perfect time. It is a great service. I'm a huge fan of Audible. I've been a member for many years. And it's just a great compliment to me. It's a great compliment to podcasts. I like listening to podcasts because I like to be able to time shift and get stuff and listen to audio on my own time, on my own schedule. And I'm very busy. Oftentimes, it's a way for me to get content and be able to do it while I'm driving around, while I'm doing other things. And audiobooks are just like that for me. I don't have a lot of time to read as much as I'd like to read more, and audiobooks are a great way to read, but with your ears, basically. So what they're offering now is a free 14-day trial of their Audible Listener Gold membership, and that includes a free audiobook download. So if you go to audiblepodcast.com/maccast and sign up, you're going to get immediately a free audiobook, and you get to try out the service for 14 days. They have a ton of titles to choose from, over 100,000 now, and it just keeps growing. Really great stuff. The service works on literally hundreds of devices, including all your iOS devices, your Android devices. You can get your audiobooks and move them around between different platforms. So if you have multiple devices and you can pick up your audiobooks, you know, from one device to another, it's really great. And, you know, if they have great titles, fiction, nonfiction. You can get the Steve Jobs biography right now. So if you haven't read that, you can get that as your free audiobook download or any other book of your choice. And like I said, it's a really great compliment to listening to podcasts. And you should check it out. Audiblepodcast.com/MacCast is the place to go. And a big thank you to Audible for their support of the MacCast. So I believe just on the last episode, I was talking about some of the changes coming in Mountain Lion and specifically Gatekeeper, but also a technology related to that, something called sandboxing that is being required for any Mac developers who want to release a Mac app on the Mac App Store. And there was a deadline coming up. It had already been extended once, and the general impression was that Apple might extend the deadline again. Well, they actually did that this week. They extended the sandboxing deadline for all App Store apps. This time they've moved it to June 1st. Initially, it was supposed to be, well, when they originally said it was supposed to be on November 2011, and then in November they extended the deadline to March 2012, and now they've extended that deadline again. Apple did note that in the recent release, well, I guess I should back up a little bit. One of the reasons for the delay potentially could be that many developers have been upset that there are not enough what's called entitlements. And I think we talked about this on the last episode as well. In case you missed it, what sandboxing does is kind of puts applications in their own space within the operating system and limits what they can do outside of that space. And we've had sandboxing on iOS for a while. They're trying to bring it into Mac applications, and it will help make things more secure, potentially more stable, but it also poses some challenges because there's certain parts of the operating system that applications can't get to unless they're able to access one of these entitlements, basically ask the operating system permission to access certain portions of it. And there aren't enough of these entitlements available to do enough of the things that many applications need to do. There's a lot of applications that integrate pretty tightly into the operating system. They need to get file system access or other types of access. And developers had been complaining not enough of these entitlements were out there. So Apple pointed out that when they moved this deadline, they pointed out that OS 10.7.3, which was just released recently, does include some additional entitlements to do things like access files, send and receive Apple events, use hardware resources. That was one of the complaints, was a lot of apps needed access to things like FireWire or USB. Apple extended those, so they now have FireWire entitlements and FaceTime camera entitlements, also entitlements for connecting to the internet to do different things. So Apple added a bunch of these in 10.7.3, and that's a good thing, but there is a potential issue that applications that use these new entitlements won't run properly if a user hasn't updated from an earlier version of 10.7. So the new entitlements only work if you're running 10.7.3. If you haven't upgraded, then you could potentially download an application that wouldn't work. Interestingly, if you're running 10.6, the apps will run without the sandboxing, since that wasn't part of the operating system. So it'll be like they aren't sandboxed at all if you have an earlier version of the operating system. So not a perfect system. It sounds like Apple's giving developers a little bit more time to work through that. I'm not sure how they're going to work through that 10.3, 10.7 thing, but Apple is encouraging developers to file any bugs against the sandboxing system, against the entitlements, in case there's entitlements that they need that are missing. So hopefully Apple is going to extend that list of entitlements. That's what a lot of developers really want. They're probably going to need even more time than June 1st. I think Daniel Jockett of Red Sweater Software, I think rightly pointed out that Apple should just extend the deadline until the release of Mountain Lion, just roll all the sandboxing along with Gatekeeper into 10.8, and that would give developers a little more time. It could also give Apple a little more time to give more access and more entitlements to developers who need to sandbox their applications. But we'll have to see what happens. But for now, the deadline is extended until June 1st. Looks like Apple has plans to build a brand new data center, this time in Oregon. Many of us are familiar with the data center they built in North Carolina, a massive data center out there. It looks like they're looking to bring some of the operations, or expand the operations more likely, on the West Coast, this time in Oregon. There's a report out this week that Apple had purchased a 160-acre plot of land in Prineville, Oregon. Actually, interestingly, the deed for that land was signed on the same day that Oregon passed a huge tax break for corporations wanting to build data centers in the state. So good news for Apple. I guess Facebook reportedly already has a huge data center there and would also benefit from this new tax break. But Apple reportedly purchased the land for $5.6 million from Crook County. And a February 15th filing first identified Apple Inc. as the purchaser of the land. Apple later did confirm the purchase and said they're looking to build a new green data center in the region. Apple had just last week got some awards and certifications for the data center in North Carolina for its environmentally friendly nature. And I had reported on the fact that Apple's looking to power that facility using solar and some other alternative energy sources, and they've been getting some LEED certifications for those efforts. There's a rumor surfacing this week that your iOS devices might be getting a smaller dock connector. Apple is reportedly replacing its current dock connector for the iPhone, iPad, and iPod Touch with a smaller, what the sites are calling, micro dock, at least according to the blog iMore. They don't really offer any more details about what the connector will look like or whether or not it will support older accessories or devices, maybe through some sort of an adapter. But since the connector on the current devices has really become almost de facto standardized, it seems highly unlikely to me that Apple would want to change the connector. The rationale reportedly is so that they would have more space in the ever-shrinking, getting thinner devices. The report said it's most likely we would see the new connector on an iPhone 5, although some are speculating that it could show up in the iPad 3, which is expected to be announced soon. I don't know. I just don't buy that Apple is going to want to replace that 30-pin dock connector unless they absolutely have to. And even then, that's going to really throw some monkey wrenches out there for some of the accessories and compatibility with different kinds of docks and systems and things like that. So I think Apple would hold off as long as they possibly could. And who knows, maybe now's the time just because they're running out of space with the various designs and things that they want to do. Even with the iPad 3 announcement looming, there still seems to be a lot of debate going on over what kind and what features Apple's next generation processor might have. If you remember last week, I told you about the images that supposedly showed the iPad 3 main board with an Apple A5X processor. Now it seems like there could be actually multiple new processors on the way, and which one will end up in the iPad 3 or which device may depend on specifically the device that you get. 9to5 Mac did some deep diving into the code strings in iOS 5.1 beta, and they say they found processor references to chips labeled S5L8945X and S5L89450X. The current A5 processors, by the way, are labeled S5L8940X. So the assumption is that the 45X would be a small bump up from the current A5 processor, potentially that A5X that we've already seen and heard about, and that the 50X could be the rumored A6 processor, but who really knows? It's all a lot of speculation at this point. There's some speculation that if Apple jumped to an A6, that would be the rumored quad core that was supposedly going to be showing up in the iPad 3. A couple sources have cited a quad-core processor as the next-gen processor for the iPad 3. And then a contradictory report came out from, I believe, The Verge, saying that, no, Apple's going to go still with a dual-core processor in the iPad 3, but it'll have some bumped-up specs and a higher clock speed. And that is what many are assuming would be the A5X. So who really knows? There's also some belief that the A5X may be a processor destined for the smaller devices like the iPhone and the iPod Touch, upgrades to those, and that A6, something that would require a little bit more battery power, could make its way into something like the iPad 3, larger devices where Apple could cram in more energy. But rumors are still strong that Apple is going to announce the next generation iPad on March 7th. At least one rumor late this weekend says that the new iPads themselves could be in the U.S. and shipping by March 9th. This information came from a Chinese site that reportedly posted images of a shipping manifest that show products scheduled to arrive in the U.S. no later than March 9th. According to that source, a Foxconn executive claimed that the shipments contained Apple's quote-unquote latest products. That's rather vague if you ask me. It could simply mean that Foxconn is sending a shipment of new products to Apple, not new products as in a whole new product line like the iPad 3, but actually just a new shipment of products. But I guess there's a lot of hoping going on that the iPad 3 might be on sale right after the announcement. More likely, though, 9to5 Mac has also reported that there are severely constrained supplies of Apple TV 2. And they think a refresh could be just around the corner, maybe coinciding with the announcement of the iPad 3. And so I assume that those shipments could be new Apple TVs on their way to the U.S. for release right after the announcement, after the event on March 7th. But we'll have to wait and see. As far as what would be in a new Apple TV 3, well, the speculation is that it mostly would be upgraded processors to support 1080p video content. Not a lot of other details are available yet on that. And So I guess for now, I'm just taking all of this with a grain of salt. But I think it's pretty fair to say that we should hear something next week about when Apple's going to be making their next big announcement. So I think it's probably no secret that I am a little bit frustrated with AT&T and these reports of the data throttling. I've had many of you email me to tell me how at 1.5, 2 gigabytes on your unlimited data plan with AT&T, your grandfathered plan on your iPhone, you're getting the notification saying that you're going to be data throttled. Well, I was very happy this week when a win was chalked up for the little guy. Matt Spaccarelli sued AT&T in small claims court after they throttled his data connection, and they did it to him when he was just at 1.5 gigabytes of throughput on his unlimited data plan. He went to court and he argued that AT&T throttled him at between 1.5 to 2 gigabytes, even though their current $30 a month plan offers 3 gigabytes of data, the same price that he pays for unlimited. You know, it's this thing, kinds of things sounds ridiculous. Now, Matt actually sued in small claims court because there's a clause in your AT&T contract, and I didn't realize this, a clause that prohibits you from taking your complaints to a class action and leaves only the option of going to arbitration or small claims court. Obviously, Matt decided to go to small claims court. He went there. AT&T was represented by a local area sales manager, Peter Hartgrove, and he argued in court that his employer has the right to modify or cancel a customer's contract if their data usage adversely affects the network. Now, again, I find it hard to believe that somebody using 1.5 gigabytes of data is adversely affecting the network, especially when AT&T sells a plan that offers up to 3 gigabytes of data throughput for that same price. And obviously, that was the argument Matt made, and the judge agreed with him. Pro Tem Judge Russell Nadell of Ventura Superior Court, that's in Simi Valley, which is in Southern California, he ruled in Spaccarelli's favor, and he awarded him $850. That amount was based on $85 a month for the 10 months left in Matt's contract. Now, AT&T could appeal the case, but my guess is that they're probably not going to do it for $850, although they could, because they could be worried that other cases like Matt's could come to trial and they could potentially lose them because it sets a bit of a precedence. So we'll have to wait and see what AT&T does. I think it would be amazing if everybody who has been data throttled by AT&T suddenly started filing small claims court cases and winning. You know, little $850 settlements by themselves probably aren't a big deal to AT&T, but if they suddenly get tens of thousands of these and start losing them, it may get them to rethink what they've done to their unlimited data customers. And I'm mostly frustrated by this. I understand what AT&T is trying to do, just so I'm clear on my position. I'm mostly frustrated by it because they're changing the rules on us, and it seems like they can change the rules whenever they want, do whatever they want, and we just got to take it. So nice to see one win for the little guy. I think I tweeted out that, you know, Matt Spaccarelli, you're now my new hero. So go, and if you've been bothered by this and you're willing to do it, you know, I'm more power to you. Take them to a small claims court and see if you can get some satisfaction that way. Apparently, more people are looking at mobile ads on iOS devices than any other device. This is according to a company called InMobi, which says that iOS ads accounted for 35% of their network ad impressions in January. That was up from 23.2% in October. Android's ad impressions, by comparison, were actually down 3.2% in the same period. So that would seem to indicate that more people are using iOS devices than Android devices. Actually, the report seems to kind of contradict sales trends that show Android devices are actually on the rise and potentially outpacing sales of Apple devices. Now, my guess is that the numbers reflect the more common theory that while Android is outselling iOS in terms of the number of units with the operating system on it, it's simply because there's more Android devices out there in the marketplace, more choices, more lower-cost phones. They're the phones that are given away free with contracts. So a lot of people simply don't realize that they're getting an Android device or really care, and potentially not using a lot of the web and data features, where more iOS users are potentially knowing what they're buying and planning to use it specifically for data, for surfing the web, for apps that have ads embedded and things like that in them. So definitely not an indication of which operating system is the more dominant one, but an interesting fact, and I think speaks a little bit more to usage than anything else. And then finally in the news for this week, a common complaint about the Apple App Store is that it's just darn hard to find the application that you're looking for. App discovery is the thing that everybody always talks about. How do I find the app that I want? Well, it looks like Apple may be looking to remedy the situation. This week, it came out that they purchased app search engine company Chomp, reportedly for $50 million. Now, Apple didn't confirm the purchase price, but they did confirm that they acquired the company. Speculation is that they're doing it to improve that process of app discovery on the App Store. Interestingly, though, the company also has some sophisticated analytics built into their search engine, and that gives information like what apps people are buying, what search terms that they've plugged into the system to look for those apps, and some additional information on what people do, what they're downloading, and what they're buying, and for how much. And I think Apple may be looking to get that information or that part of the company more so than the app discovery thing. The reason is that I went and tried the application. I had never heard of Chomp before. I went out and tried the application. They have a website where you can do searches. They also have an application that you can download for your iOS device. And unless I'm totally missing the point here, I really didn't see how it was that much better than what we have on iTunes already. There's some interesting sections and categories built out within the software. You can find things like trending applications. Looked and seemed very similar to me to the top 25 applications that you find on the Mac App Store. They also have some interesting analytics or sections on apps that have recently gone on sale. So if you're looking for a good deal on an app, those might be easier to find. But there's lots of sites that actually do that sort of thing. So I didn't see anything special in what Chomp was doing. Again, maybe I'm totally missing the point. Send me an email if I am. But I did a simple search for drawing, looking for drawing applications, and not one of the most popular iOS drawing apps came up. Brushes didn't come up, Sketchbook Pro didn't come up, Procreate didn't come up. None of those came up in a simple search for drawing within the software. Mostly what came up were a bunch of random drawing-based games and some funky, kitschy kind of paint applications. So maybe those are the most popular on there, but it just seemed like a lot of crudware to me. Who knows? But maybe Apple can actually make something out of this and improve the iTunes shopping app store shopping experience, which I think is something that we all want. There have been rumors this week also that Apple is getting ready to completely revamp iTunes. iTunes has been sort of one of those crusty applications that's just limped along, and Apple's thrown more and more features and functionality to support some of the stuff they're doing. And I think it's well overdue for an overhaul, both in terms of the music player functionality and also the application sale store functionality. So we'll have to see what Apple does. And I can only hope that this kind of acquisition is something that will help support that and make it better. But remains to be seen, if you ask me. And that'll do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I want to take another quick moment, thank another one of our show sponsors, Smile. I talked to you a lot about Smile's desktop applications, PDF Pen, Disk Label, Text Expander, all great apps. Also, Text Expander's Touch for your iPhone, your iOS device, your iPad, iPod Touch. But this week, I want to talk to you about PDF Pen for iPad. If you heard my Macworld interviews, you heard me talking with them, they just had released PDF Pen for iPad, and it is awesome. Let me tell you, I've been playing with it. I've been using it. It's the power of PDF Pen now on your iPad. I think many of us have been waiting for this to come along. You can do things like make text corrections, fix typos, resize images, delete or replace images, all on your iPad, all on, you know, in PDFs. And you can send those PDFs over from any other application using the Open In feature. You can also send them directly to PDF Pen for iPad with their iCloud support. So if you use iCloud and you own PDF Pen for the Mac, the latest version includes something called PDF Pen Cloud Access. With that, you can take your PDF documents, you can put them up into iCloud, and you can have those sync right over to PDF Pen for iPad. If you don't have PDF Pen for the Mac, you can get the Cloud Access application from the Mac App Store for 99 cents. So either way, you can get your PDFs through iCloud into PDF Pen on the iPad. And all those great features, like I said, are there. You can fill out fake forms. Those are the forms that look like forms. They're in PDF, but they don't actually have the form fields. You can fill out regular forms as well, but you can draw text boxes. You can add text. You can add your signatures to documents right on your iPad. So now if you get a PDF and an email, something that needs to be signed, you can sign that right on the iPad and send it back out through email with your signature in place. You can also add markup and notes. Like I said, all those great things you can do with PDF Pen on the desktop, now on the iPad, and it's just $9.99 on the App Store. So check it out. Also check out all of Smile's other great software. You can get more information and details on their website, smilesoftware.com. And a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. Going to kick things off now with a little bit of follow-up from something that I said on the last MacCast. I had been talking about security and this whole kerfuffle with the Path application on iOS. The report that came out that they were uploading your entire contact database from your iOS device without really asking you. And that prompted a bunch of applications to go modify how they were doing things, because a lot of apps were doing this, not just Path. They would, you know, to use the Find My Friends or Find Other Users on this application service, they would upload your address book in the background, all of your address data, the phone numbers, contacts, all that information. And I had kind of argued and said, I don't really understand the modifications that they made are now just asking you permission. So they pop up an alert dialog box and say, hey, to use this feature, we need to upload your address book or your contact data to our servers. And I was arguing that, no, they absolutely don't need to do that. They can handle this in another way. They can, you know, they're only using it for the matching. So really, they only need one bit of information, like an email address, and they could upload the email addresses, but they could even do one better. They, instead of uploading the email addresses, they could simply take the email address on the iOS device and within the app, turn that into an encrypted hash and obfuscate, basically turn that into just gibberish that then gets uploaded to their servers, and then just do the matching on the hashed information. So in case that's a little bit confusing how that works, essentially what you could do is say you were in my address book and I had your email address in my address book. They would take that email address and they would run it through an algorithm and they would turn it into a long encrypted string. And on your device, when you signed up for the service, they would take your email address and do the exact same thing to it. Using the same algorithm, they would turn it into this hashed bit of information. And so once both those were uploaded to their servers, they could compare those two and they would be unique, but they would match because they were hashed in the same way, or they were encrypted in the same way. And I had said that to add an additional layer of security, rather than just taking my email address, they could add a little bit of random information to the beginning or to the end of it, something that I called salting, and then run it through the hashing algorithm to encrypt it. And the reason for that is that that means if somebody knew, if a hacker got access to that database and downloaded all that hashed information, they could potentially reverse engineer that algorithm and get the information back out, meaning my email address. And specifically, they'd have an easier time with it if they already took a whole list of known email addresses. So if they somehow got a list of email addresses, or even probably more likely just took all the common names and ran those through and combined them with a bunch of the very popular email services. So if they just took, you know, adam@gmail.com, bob@gmail.com, steve@gmail.com, and took all of those and ran them through a hashing algorithm and then tried to match them, they could potentially start matching email addresses and get that information out. Well, if you take that email address and before you encrypt it, you add some additional data to it that's only known to the company or to the software, then that's one more bit of information that the hackers would need to have to kind of decrypt your information, to unhash that information. And I call that salting, and I need to make a correction because it's technically not what salting is. What salting is adding that bit of additional information to the thing that's going to be encrypted, but it's supposed to be done and be unique each time so that the resulting hashed string is different every time. It's not going to match anything else. It's going to end up being unique. And in my case, you couldn't have that because that would mean that the two matching email addresses after being salted and hashed would not match, would completely defeat the purpose. So security people have pointed out that what I was talking about is not salting. It's more just a way of adding some additional information to make it harder for a hacker to match and potentially decrypt that information. So in my case, the purpose of my example would be that only the application and the service would know what that additional little bit of information is. It would be added to whatever information that they want to protect, and it would make it a bit more difficult for the hackers to brute force kind of decrypt it. And the ultimate point is that it avoids the ability to simply reverse engineer the hashing algorithm and get the information, say like a stolen email address, back out of the system. So I think in the end, the point of it is that regardless of what you want to call it, I call it salt just for lack of a better term, the ultimate goal is to have something that's only known to the application that adds an extra layer of randomness to the thing that they're matching on. And that would make it a bit more difficult for the hacker because they need to know that extra little bit of information. And it makes it more complex than just having to reverse engineer the hashing algorithm. The end game for all of this is adding that additional layer of complexity, adds that one more thing, and better protects your data, your information from getting back out of their system. And I think that the ultimate point is still remains the same, is that they do not need to be uploading all of your address book data. They do not need that information. And even a little bit of information, you could argue, well, then they can just upload email addresses, you know, the one email address from each account or the email addresses from each account in the address book. I still say they don't even need that to do the functionality that they want to accomplish. And they need to be a little bit more responsible and a little bit more protective of that data. And my example was just one way they could potentially do that. So I hope that helps better explain things and makes sense. And yes, it's not technically salting, but you know, for lack of a better term, that's what I called it. And I guess somewhat related to security or better protecting your privacy, I had been reading these reports, I think last week, about something called the Do Not Track. I think the news story was that Google finally in Chrome was going to support this feature called Do Not Track for cookies, or specifically for advertising, for ads that you encounter when you're surfing the web. And the reports have said, well, all the other browsers, Firefox and Safari, support this feature. And I had never really heard about it or really never knew how I would actually enable it or use it in Safari. And so I dug in a little bit. And what it is it's a technology that uses the HTTP headers from your browser. This is something every time your browser communicates from and to and from the server, these headers get sent back and forth. And so it would send header information to the server saying, hey, I don't want to be tracked by your advertisers. This little bit of information that goes across. And apparently, Apple started supporting it with Safari 5.1, and you can enable it, but enabling it is a bit hidden. So this is how you do it. To enable it, you actually need to turn on the developer menu. And I've talked about the developer menu in the past. It has some great features and some things that you can do with it. So you likely have it turned on already if you listen to the MacCast. But in case you don't, you go into Safari, you go under Preferences, you go into Advanced, and then you'll see a little checkbox there down at the bottom that says Show Developer Menu in Menu Bar. You check that on, and then suddenly in the menu bar, you'll have a new menu called Developer. There's a bunch of great stuff you can do in there. I use the Web Inspector all the time for doing web development and playing around with CSS and debugging JavaScript and things like that. So you can do those sorts of things, but you can also enable the Do Not Track option. And once you have the developer menu there, you can go to the developer menu and you can choose the option that says Send Do Not Track HTTP Header. and you turn that on. And then now, anytime you encounter a site, it'll send that information along. Apparently, this option is going to be more visible in Mountain Lion. It's being moved to the privacy pane. So that makes a lot more sense. I guess they've just been playing around with it in Safari 5.1. But exactly what does it do? That was kind of my next question. It's great, I can turn it on, but what is it actually going to do? And it tells advertisers to stop using cookies that would craft target-based ads based on your surfing habits. So things like it's watching that I go to a lot of Mac websites and it starts delivering me Mac-based ads because that information is in my cookie. So it'll stop collecting that information, or not necessarily collecting that information. It will stop using that information to deliver me ads. Doesn't necessarily mean they're going to stop collecting that information. It's just not going to be used to influence the ads that I'm going to see. Now, I would assume that they would still take that data and use it to craft demographic profiles and do other sorts of things that they would share with their potential advertisers, saying, hey, we know that people who come to our websites are also going to these types of websites or doing these sorts of things online. So I don't know how it really helps. I also discovered that the setting is only honored if the user goes in and enables it themselves. So you have to actually opt out for them to honor the setting. They've said that, you know, if a browser came out with this option enabled by default, or if it was always on, they wouldn't necessarily honor that. The end user, they're saying, has to enable that feature. So I think this has a little bit of ways to go before it's truly kind of protecting our privacy. And frankly, if you ask me, I kind of don't mind them using some of that information because I prefer getting targeted ads that are more relevant to me and to what I do and my interests and stuff like that. But I think it is important that we all have the option to choose that for ourselves and to kind of know what's being tracked and what information is being collected and say, nope, I don't want you to have that kind of information. So that's how you enable it, and a little bit about what Do Not Track is. Now, I think I don't want to waste any more time in getting to our special guest, to our interview. You know, I said at the top of the show, I don't use Automator all that much, but when I do, I'm constantly impressed with the kinds of things that I can do with it. And I often get sucked in. I'll start thinking about, oh, hey, I want to do this kind of thing on my Mac, this automated process. And, oh, I wonder if I can do that with Automator. And so I'll pop open the Automator application and I'll play around and see what I can do with it. And I find very often that several hours later, I've created something even more complex and kind of cooler than what I set out to do. But just getting in and diving in and knowing where to start and how do I do this and what do I do with Automator, that can be a little bit daunting. If you open the application just, you know, without knowing anything about it, it can be a little bit confusing. And so I thought it'd be great to get Ben Waldy on. He has a website at automatedworkflows.com, and he wrote the Visual Quick Start Guide for Automator for Mac OS X for Peach Pit. You can order it directly from Peach Pit. You can get it from Amazon if you want to check it out. He also does podcasts, and he has training that's available. You can also get now through the Mac App Store some of his Automator actions. Additional actions, and we're going to get into what actions are. So if you don't know what those are yet, just stay tuned, but we'll get into what those are. It's additional functionality that you can add in and use in your Automator workflows. So you can get those and a bunch of other stuff. Just check out his website, automatedworkflows.com. But I thought, here's a great opportunity. Let's dive in and talk a little bit about Automator. So here's my conversation with Ben.
So Ben, how you doing?
Very good. How are you?
Excellent. I want to thank you for coming on and kind of helping us demystify Automator a little bit. I've covered this a few times on the MacCast, but it's one of those things that I think it's there in Mac OS X. A lot of people know about it, but it is a little bit of a mystery to a lot of people, I think.
Yes, exactly. And that's, I think, one of the fallacies about Automator is Apple kind of made it out to be this tool that it's there. It's so easy to use. Anybody can do it. So people see it there, you know, in their launch pad or their applications folder, but they don't really know what to do with it. And once they launch it, they're even more confused. So,
yeah, you got Otto. He looks all nice and friendly sitting in your dock, you know.
Exactly. Yep.
For those people who don't know, Otto is the little Automator bot character, right? That's his name, right? Otto?
Yeah, Otto, O-T-T-O. And he looks, yeah, it's a pretty neat little robot icon. So it does look enticing.
Friendly and simple. So I want to start off with the basics, and maybe we'll get you back to do some advanced stuff. I'm looking for feedback. So those of you who are listening, you know, send us feedback. Let us know what you want to know about Automator and scripting and doing this stuff on your Mac. And, you know, Ben, as I said in the intro, he's the guy. He literally wrote the book on Automator, right, Ben?
Yep, exactly.
So
Visual Quick Start Guide. So
yeah, in your words, what is Automator for people who haven't run across it or haven't seen the icon?
Yeah, so first, I guess let me just say that some of the Automator, it's a little bit hard to talk about without actually seeing it. So right. So we'll do our best. But I think sometimes you have to just kind of play around with it to learn it. So what Automator is it was released with OS 10.4 Tiger, and it was this awesome tool that Apple made available with the intent of giving users a way to automate time-consuming or repetitive things that they might do manually on their Macs. So things like, you know, processing a bunch of photos or generating a bunch of emails, things like that. They could have a tool to do that. And it's really, I like to say, it's the first tool that really brings the power of multiple application automation to the user level. So you don't have to be like a programmer or a scripter to use Automator. Anybody can use it. And it is relatively easy to use, but it does also have a learning curve as well. So, but yeah, I mean, Automator, it's an application designed to automate things on your Mac. So one thing you want to keep in mind, I guess, about it is that it's not designed for really complex automation. It's mostly for relatively simple tasks. So you're not going to build, you know, some complicated Automator workflow that's going to build a, you know, catalog in InDesign and send it to your printer or something like that. But you might build a workflow to just do small things that you do on a daily basis.
Right, right. And I think you hit on a good point there, too, is that it's something that is system-wide and application-wide. It's application kind of independent, assuming, of course, you know, some caveats that a certain application has added in support for it. But across the operating system, for at least Apple's built-in applications, you know, it's pretty universal in terms of what you can do. And I think we'll get into some of the ins and outs, the libraries and sort of how you use it. But I think another area of confusion that I had, and I think people have when you look at Automator, especially those of us who have been in the Apple community for a long time, is prior to Automator, we had AppleScript, right? And
right.
AppleScript was this kind of little more technical, a little more programmy kind of thing, but it seems like there's a lot of similarities between Automator and AppleScript. So can you talk a little bit about, you know, how is Automator different than AppleScript?
Sure. So AppleScript is it's a scripting language. It's been in the Mac operating system for years. I think it came out with System 7.1 or something like that. But you actually have to write code to automate things. So you there's a much bigger learning curve or much steeper learning curve with AppleScript than with Automator. With both AppleScript and Automator, you are for the most part automating things in applications or with processes on your Mac. So for example, you want to control Photoshop. So you might automate some task in Photoshop, but you're not going to write a Photoshop application with AppleScript, or you're not going to build a Photoshop, you know, with Automator.
Right.
So there are tools for controlling the apps on your Mac to do things that you would otherwise do manually. Now, AppleScript, both AppleScript and Automator, the applications that you control, they have to support those technologies. So if you want to write a script to do something in iTunes, iTunes has to have AppleScript knowledge of the things that you want to do. It has to have terminology to automate those different tasks. And with Automator, you build essentially a workflow of tasks. And just like kind of the AppleScript world, in the Automator world, the applications have to have Automator actions available in order for you to automate things. So Automator it comes with, I think, a few hundred actions for doing things in a lot of Apple's applications. So there are things for doing, there are actions for doing things in iTunes and mail and address book and things like that. But there are not actions for every single thing that you might want to do in the operating system. There are things that Apple understands are commonly automated or commonly performed tasks that people might want to automate.
Right.
One other difference with Automator is that when you build a workflow, again, you're not writing any code or anything. So you're just taking these pre-built actions. Some other developer has already written the code for you, and you're putting these things together then to build a workflow and perform this series of tasks.
Right.
Now, a lot of Automator actions are actually written in AppleScript. So developers can write Automator actions with AppleScript. So they are kind of intertwined technologies.
Right. Well, let's talk a little bit about that and maybe get into, you mentioned some things there in terms of actions and workflows. And I think that becomes important when you're trying to understand Automator. And as you said, it sometimes gets easier to get in and just play with these tools. But what I'm hoping to do here for you is give you an idea of the things you can do and demystify. You know, Ben and I are trying to demystify it so that you can go in and work with workflows and actions. So let's talk about what kinds of things Automator can do and can't do, and then maybe dive a little bit into after that how to build a basic workflow and use the actions and stuff like that. So actions kind of define what Automator can and can't do, right? I mean, is that a good way to put it?
Yeah, an action is usually one specific task. So let's say you want to create a folder somewhere. There's an Automator action for creating a folder. And then if you want to put stuff in that folder, you know, you would maybe go find another action to move or copy things into the folder. So then you piece these actions together to build a workflow. So Automator has a lot of these different actions, and each action usually does one specific task. I mean, some of them can combine multiple tasks together, but overall, in general, each action does like one specific thing.
Right. Right, and then you assemble those together to do the workflow. So, is there anything really specific that people need to know about that Automator can't do versus what it can do?
Yes. So, Automator does have some limitations. So, probably the biggest limitation is that there's only so many actions available. So, Apple, like I said, Apple gives you a few hundred actions to do things in OS X, but it doesn't have actions for every single thing that you might want to do. So that kind of throws people off a little bit when they go to build a workflow because they might want to automate something, but they can't find an action to do what they need. As you install third-party applications, like the Microsoft Office applications are one example. If you install the full version of Office, you get about 90-something actions for Word, PowerPoint, Excel, and Outlook. And so those actions, so as you install applications, you can get more actions. They'll just kind of show up in Automator. The application Fetch or Transmit or Pixelmator is a good one. Mm-hmm. It's a popular image editor in the Mac App Store. So as you install some of these third-party applications, their actions will show up and extend what Automator can do. But even so, you know, you might install, say, Pixelmator, and they give you maybe 10 or 20 actions. But there's, you know, thousands of things you could do in Pixelmator manually. So it's not going to let you do every single thing.
Right. Right. And I want to come back to actions later, especially third-party actions or add-on actions, because I have some questions related to when you build Automator workflows and want to distribute them or mm-hmm. share them with people, which you can do. Yep. How all of that works. So let's table that, and I want to come back to that. But let's just talk a little bit now about workflows and what they are, because there's more than one kind of workflow, right? You can create different types of workflows.
Yeah. So you can create different types of workflows. One type is just a workflow document, which you know you can run it in Automator. You can double click it, and it'll open in Automator. But you can also build an application workflow, which just like any other application in OS X, you double click on it and it runs. And you can also, when you create an application workflow, they're drag and droppable by default. So let's say you're building a workflow that processes images. You could drag images onto the application, the Automator application or the Automator workflow application you created, and those images will get passed kind of through your workflow and processed. So those are two types. There's other types too. Another one that's really useful is a service workflow. So in OS X, I'm sure everybody's or a lot of people have seen, if you go up to like your application menu, there's a little services sub menu, and nobody ever really knows what that menu is for. but what it's for is adding little bits of functionality into your application. So for example, if you're in say a text edit document, you can select some text and then go up to that menu and you can create an email message with that text. Well, with Automator, you can create little workflows and add them into that menu too. So you can create service workflows, and when you save them, they show up in that menu. And so this allows you to create workflows that do things to selected text in TextEdit, or maybe selected files in the Finder, things like that. So it's actually a pretty powerful kind of workflow that you can create, or type of workflow that you can create. You can kind of be very specific about the kind of information you want the workflow to process.
Right.
And it integrates right with all different applications throughout the operating system. Any application that supports services, you can now add little workflows to help with stuff. And there are a number of other kinds of workflows too. There's an iCal alarm workflow, which lets you create a workflow that runs on a schedule. So maybe you have a workflow or a set of tasks that you want to run every night. Maybe you want to, you know, copy files from one hard drive to another every night at midnight. You could do that.
That right there is an amazing thing. And people probably should just let that sink in, because you often, you know, often get asked, well, I want to do a backup, or what kind of backup software should I run, or I want to keep these two folders in sync on my Mac, but I want to be able to schedule that. You know, every night I work during the day on this certain document folder, and I want all these documents to get pushed over to an external hard drive. You know, what software do you recommend for that? And there's a lot of great apps for doing that sort of thing, but you know, you have Automator, and you can literally build your own if you really wanted to, and do it with a workflow and an iCal alarm.
Yeah, exactly. And I actually have a client that when I'm at their office, I work on one of their machines, and they don't back up their user machines, like the end user machines. They back up their servers.
Right.
So I've built an Automator workflow that runs on a schedule that backs up stuff from my desktop and my documents folder to a folder on the server where stuff is getting backed up on a regular basis.
Yeah. So it you know, it's really amazing. And just to remind everybody, the workflow really is just kind of like a series of these actions that you kind of link together. So let's maybe jump into just building a really simple workflow. I don't think we're going to get too complex, but if I'm just starting out with Automator, I see the auto icon there, I launch it. Now I'm presented with what? How does it kind of work, and how can I build a little simple workflow?
Yes. So when you launch Automator for the first time, or anytime you launch it, it creates a new workflow document for you. And you're presented with a little panel that gives you a choice of the kinds of workflows that you can create. So it's like a template chooser kind of. And a lot of times, like if you create a document in, you know, Microsoft Word or something like that, you usually choose what kind of file you want to save it as when you save it. But with Automator, you choose it up front. So you're saying, okay, I want to create an application. So, you know, that's one of the options that shows up in this template chooser.
Yeah, let's go with that one, because people are going to see the ones we just talked about, you know, where you have a iCal alarm workflow or a service workflow. But let's just keep it real simple and just say we're going to build application.
Okay. So suppose I want to build an Automator application that will maybe scale some images.
Perfect.
So I would launch Automator and from this template chooser choose application. And then I have an Automator workflow. The Automator document remains open. And the template chooser kind of goes away. Now on the left side of this Automator document, I have a list of categories and actions, and I can kind of navigate through the categories. So if I want to process images, there's actually a photos category where all of my image related actions can appear. But you can also, there's a search field, and you can type in some keywords or something to kind of narrow down the results. So if I wanted to say scale images, I could type scale, and then that, you know, narrows down the list of hundreds of actions to just maybe one or two.
Right.
And then if I select an action, there's also a description area that shows me a little bit of information about the action, maybe what the action does, what kind of information it can process as input. So like scale images, that action can process files as input, or maybe what kind of output the action can produce so that another action can take the result of it and process it further. So scale images, there's an action called scale images. If I find that action and I select it, I can drag it over to the workflow area. With that particular action, Automator actually will display an alert kind of letting you know, hey, this image is going to, or this action is going to modify your image files. And it offers to let you insert an additional action to back up those images first or copy them somewhere so that you don't actually accidentally modify your originals.
So it tries to kind of help you, you know, avoid making some common mistakes. It sounds
right.
Like,
yeah, I mean, so like scaling your images, that's not something you can really undo unless you maybe revert to like a time machine backup or something.
Right.
So yeah, Automator tries to help make sure that you don't accidentally modify your images the wrong way. So if you choose to insert this additional action, it will insert a copy action first before scaling, so you can, you know, work with copies of your originals, and then if you make a mistake, you can go back to those originals.
Right.
So when you add scale images or any action to the workflow, to the workflow area, you get like a little interface or a little window for each action, and that window lets you configure different settings for the action. So with scale images, you can set how much you want it to scale. You can scale it to a certain number of pixels, or you can scale it by a percentage, maybe like 50%. Or something like that, and then that's pretty much a basic workflow. It's just you can create a workflow with one action. So scale images, that could be your entire workflow. If you create an application workflow, it's automatically set to receive files as input. So if you save that workflow, if you save it, it saves as an application. If you then drag a bunch of images onto it, they will just get passed to the workflow and scaled to whatever percentage or pixel size you specified when you built it.
Cool.
So that's really like the simplest workflow you can create is just a one action, you know, here, scale these images. But there's all kinds of other actions you could add for, you know, converting the type of images or cropping the images or rotating them or whatever. And that's just for images.
Right. Right. So these workflows, you know, I can't remember where I read this, and it might have been even from your site or in one of your books. Somebody described it to me as kind of like workflows are almost like recipes.
Yeah. And, yeah. You can think of it that way. You're building a recipe, and the actions are your ingredients.
Right. And in the end, you're gonna come up with this kind of great finished thing, which is
right.
Processing all my, you know, images that are from this folder that I just dropped on there, you know, to the right size for uploading to my website.
Exactly.
And like you said, I could even at that point, you know, do the resizing, and if I have Transmit, you know, application like Transmit installed where they do add in actions for doing like FTP, I could even have it upload those images directly to a folder on my website.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Another example that I give a lot when I talk about Automator is when I wrote my PeachPit book, I had to provide PeachPit with images of a certain size, and they wanted all images. So screenshots. I was taking tons and tons of screenshots for my book, and they wanted all the screenshots to be in TIFF format, black and white. And so I might have 100 screenshots for a chapter. And rather than open every one of those in Photoshop or Preview or something and try to convert them, I just created an Automator workflow that I could just drag images onto. And within a few seconds, it would take the images, change them from PNG, which is the default format I was getting, to TIFF, and convert them to black and white. And so, you know, I might, within 30 seconds, have 100 images converted to black and white TIFF.
Right. This is the kind of power and ease of sort of processing stuff that Automator can bring if you start to really understand it. And I think you're right. I think part of the thing with Automator, and I've played around with it a few times, and every time I use it, I kind of get it a little bit more, Right. You start to understand it a little bit more. So it is almost one of those kinds of things that you have to just play around with. And you really can. I mean, you can build some simple workflows just for fun, just to kind of understand it and learn it. You talked a little bit earlier about this concept of sort of the inputs and outputs of an action. And I think that's kind of important, really understanding how Automator works and how these workflows work. And one of the areas that I often kind of got confused about when I started playing with it is, what happens when I have a problem? You know, you start stringing things together and you think something's going to work, and then suddenly it doesn't do it, and you get the little red X and it says, oh, there's a problem with your workflow. So talk about a little bit, you know, inputs and outputs, how you test a workflow, and how you can sort of troubleshoot and fix it if something goes wrong.
Yeah. So I also just want to mention, you had asked about limitations of Automator.
Yep.
There are other limitations other than just not having actions available to do tasks that you want. One limitation is that Automator, it can't make decisions. So it can't say, look at a file, and if the file exists, do one thing, and if it doesn't exist, do something else. There's no kind of branching logic that you can do in an Automator workflow. And that can limit what you can do.
Yeah, they're very linear, right?
Right. Yeah, very linear. And also another limitation too is Automator has limited looping capabilities. So it can run a workflow, say, over and over again. But a lot of times people don't want to do that. What they want to do is maybe loop through a bunch of files and do something to them. And that, without the use of third-party actions, it's just not possible. Automator doesn't have a way to loop through information. So there are some limitations like that can kind of hold you up.
Right.
As far as the way actions kind of go together in a workflow, yes, Automator is very linear. So when you build a workflow, you're taking all these different tasks and you're putting them together in kind of like a line. And when the workflow runs, it starts and it runs in sequence from start to finish, unless you have a loop, which can loop all the way back to the beginning. But in general, it runs in sequence from start to finish. And then information can be passed between actions. So let's say you're processing images with the scale images action. That action, it needs images to process. So you have to kind of have something that passes images to it as input. And that something could be just the fact that you've saved an application workflow and you've dragged images onto it. Or there could be an action that passes images down to the scale images action. And then the scale images action can take information. So its result, it has a result. Its result is the scaled images, and it can pass them down to another action. So you can build this kind of assembly line of tasks that pass information between one another. But again, it goes in sequence in a very linear way.
Right. So what happens when something goes wrong? So, you know, I've said my scale images action, and I didn't pass it the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I passed it a bunch of you know, say text files for some reason.
Yeah. So a lot of time, Automator is not very easy to troubleshoot, especially if you're running your application outside of Automator. So if you say you've built an Automator application, you drag a bunch of text files onto it, and that application processes images. The error that you get might not be a message or anything. It might just be that the workflow just doesn't do anything. It could be that you get an error of some kind. The easiest way to troubleshoot an Automator workflow is to actually open the workflow in Automator and try to run it there. Because in Automator, you have a few things that can help you find where the problem has occurred. One thing is Automator has a log that you can display, and that will show you kind of information about what's happening as the workflow runs. It'll show you the names of the actions that are running. It'll show you maybe the information that's being passed between the actions. And if an error occurs, it might even tell you what the error was or the reason that the error occurred. So that's the first thing that you want to check is Automator's log. Another thing that you can do is in an Automator workflow, each action has a little results tab that you can click. And as you run a workflow, you can watch the results of each action and see that the right information is being passed between actions. So let's say you're processing text files and you're trying to process them with an image action. That's something that you might be able to detect by looking at the results of each action. So you can see visually that text files are being passed to my image action, and that's maybe why the error has occurred or why nothing got processed.
Right. And so in the interface, so people can just kind of visualize it, we talked about how each action is kind of its own little panel or its own little window. Down there at the bottom, as you're running a workflow within the workflow editor, that's where that information is. There's a couple different tabs, and results is one of those tabs down there, right?
Yeah, each action has a results tab. So you can view the results for all of your actions if you click each of their tabs. And then the log is kind of a separate area in the workflow area.
Yeah.
Which both. Is, I think it's hidden by, I'm not sure if it's hidden by default or not, but there's a view menu, and you can just say view log from the menu bar.
Right. And both those are very helpful when you're trying to work through this stuff. I can speak from experience. The other thing I think to point out, and you know, I'm a developer, I'm a programmer, so I'm kind of used to object-oriented programming and some of this other stuff. And I think it's really important when you're coming from that kind of background or you're getting into Automator to understand this linear nature. The other thing that it seems to me that in working with Automator workflows that I've run into is that you have to kind of be very, what I call verbose. In other words, each step is just a very small kind of task, and you really have to link, if you're doing something very complex, it seems like you have to link a lot of small tasks together. So there's a lot of this input, output, and you can end up with these, what feels like these really long, complex workflows for even doing what ultimately feels like a simple task, right?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yep.
I mean, is that fair to say?
Yes. I mean, so suppose you wanted to create a workflow that's going to get images, copy them somewhere, scale them, and upload them. Well, each of those steps is a separate action or potentially even more than one action.
Exactly.
So you can end up with a fairly lengthy workflow that it just feels like a lot to do a very simple, small number of tasks.
Right. But I think that's why you end up with the kind of the simplicity in all the underlying programming, because there's even more complexity going on under the hood. But what you're doing is you're dragging in these little actions and just kind of hooking them together. And I think once I started getting past that mental block for me, that, mm-hmm. okay, I have to do one little step and then the next little step, you know, it's sort of like baby steps, one right after the other. Then it seemed to be to get easier for me to kind of build Automator workflows and kind of get it and understand, oh, why this isn't working. Well, it's because, you know, you just assumed that it was going to do more than it was. You know, I assumed it was going to pull in these files or manipulate these files in a certain way. It's like, no, I have to tell it, do this with these files, then pass it to this action, then do this, then pass it to this action to do that. You know, sort of one, two, three, four, however many steps.
Yeah, you have to be very specific. Very, very specific. I'll also say that I think one of the hard things for people with Automator is to figure out how to get started building a workflow. Like, suppose I want to automate some workflow. Where do I get started? And one thing that I recommend is maybe just doing the steps manually the way that you would normally do them, but then outlining just on a sheet of paper or somewhere. Here's what I'm doing. You know, I'm moving this file from here to here. I'm, you know, opening it in this application because each of those steps might be an action.
Right.
And so when you go to build your workflow, you can go from this outline and kind of build your workflow around the outline.
That's very, very good advice. I think we've kind of covered a lot of the basics. I might want to get you back on to talk a little bit about some more of the advanced stuff like looping and variables and stuff like that, if you'd be open for that.
Sure.
But let's talk a little bit about, you know, where people can go to get more information. Obviously, you work a lot with Automator. You wrote books. You have tutorials and information. You have a website. So if people want to actually see this stuff, get more actions, find out some more information, where can they go and access your stuff, Ben?
My website is automatedworkflows.com. And there I have a number of Automator resources. One is my Automator book for Peach Pit, which is Automator for macOS 10 Visual Quick Start Guide. It's a Snow Leopard edition, and we didn't release a Lion edition just because Apple didn't change Automator enough to warrant a whole new edition. So everything's still relevant in the Snow Leopard version.
Okay.
So that's one thing.
Wait, before we get on to the next thing, just real quick, since you mentioned it, and I did want to hit this, Automator and Lion. So what has changed in Automator and Lion, or is there anything really significant that people should know about?
There's not a whole lot of major changes. One thing is it makes use of versions, so you can save versions of your workflows. It also has autosave. So it's kind of really overall Lion features. Right. Other than that, it lets you it will let you duplicate a workflow, which is kind of part of the autosave.
Right.
So you can duplicate a workflow to another type. So let's say you create an application workflow and now you want to save it as an iCal alarm. You can duplicate it to an iCal alarm.
Oh, that's great. That makes it easier to kind of port workflows from one kind to another.
Yeah, especially like if you forget or you're not sure what kind of workflow you want to create when you get started. Another thing too is just that there's a number of new actions that they've added. Not a ton, but a handful of them. So I mean that's really about it that's changed. Nothing significant in the interface.
Cool. Okay, so they should check out your book, your website.
Yeah, I have a tips section of my website where I have links to dozens of articles that I've written, as well as videos that I've done for Peach Pit. I did a series called Mac Automation Made Simple, and they're video podcasts that have basically, they're just tutorials. They're screencasts of how to build simple things in Automator mostly, but also a little bit of AppleScript stuff. And also, I want to mention that there's another website you can go to. It's not my website, but macosxautomation.com, where people can find a lot of downloadable workflows. There are a ton of Automator workflows already created online all over the place that you can download, but that's a good resource for them.
Yeah.
And I've also released some actions in the Mac App Store as well for doing things with files and folders and text that, you know, do more than what Automator gives you built in.
Right, right. Okay, I'm extending. I'm going to extend it 5 more minutes because this is one area that I personally want to ask about. And I'll just say that Ben has helped me out with some Automator workflows in the past, and I met you at Macworld a couple years ago, I think.
Yep.
And I really appreciate his help. So check out his stuff; it's really good, and hey, you definitely know this stuff inside and out. But related to third party actions, because I have written some workflows and I've kind of stuck to the built-in stuff because if I want to go share them, if I get third-party workflows, can they get bundled in, or how do you handle distribution if you want to share something and you've incorporated some workflow that's not built out of the box? If I save it as an application, does those actions get bundled in, or how does that work?
No.
Okay.
No, you can send workflows around to anybody you want. But in order for them to actually run the workflow, they have to have the actions installed. So if you build a workflow for Microsoft Office and you send it to somebody and they don't have the Office actions installed,
right,
then they're not going to be able to run the workflow. And if they try to open the workflow in Automator, they're going to get an error that says, you know, that there are actions that this workflow uses, which can't be found on your computer. And,
right.
It'll still let them open it, but they won't be able to see those actions. They're kind of, you know, grayed out because they're not there. They don't exist.
Right. So a great example is, like, I remember writing a workflow one time, and I don't know if this is still the case because it was a long time ago when I wrote this, but I wanted to be able to have the action or the workflow delete some files. Mm-hmm. And I don't believe there's a default, or there might be one for moving files to the trash or and not emptying the trash. I don't remember, but there's something specifically related to deleting files within the Finder. And I think it was maybe emptying the trash, and that wasn't a default workflow, but I found a third-party workflow for that. But then I wasn't really sure how can I, you know, if I want to share this with somebody, I'm going to have to send them the action, the third-party actions along with the workflow application, right?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, some third-party actions are free and some are commercial. So
exactly.
You'd have to check with the action developer to see, like, my file and folder actions, I have an action for emptying the trash because Apple doesn't give you one for that. They have one for moving things to the trash, but not for emptying it. And so if someone was to create a workflow that emptied the trash using my action and then deliver that workflow to somebody else, they're free to do that. But that person that's getting the delivery would have to have my action pack from the App Store as well.
Right. So you'd have to purchase that. So you got to watch if you're thinking, I mean, I think the bottom line is Automator is really something that's built in. You can build some powerful applications with it, and you can potentially distribute those, but you are going to need to, if you're using third-party actions, you're going to need to check and make sure you have licensing or permission to do that. So if you're not using open source or free actions that give you a commercial license, if you're using third-party commercial actions, you need to just check on that.
Right. Yeah, and there are certainly actions out there that are free. For all different kinds of things. But there are also commercial ones. And then there are actions that are bundled with applications like Office, which probably you would not be allowed due to licensing to distribute.
Right, right. But you certainly could write a workflow and then share that with anybody who had Office installed.
Yeah, because the workflow just references the actions.
Cool. All right, great. Thanks for kind of explaining that part of it, because that was always confusing to me. Well, Ben, I want to thank you for taking some time out of your day and coming on and talking to us about Automator, maybe just demystifying it a little bit. And so people should check out your website, automatedworkflows.com. And thanks for coming on the MacCast.
Yeah, thanks very much for having me.
There you go. That's Ben Waldy and a little bit of Automator. I hope you enjoyed that. And with that, I think that's going to do it for this episode. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Phoronix, makers of Deep Freeze. You can check out their software. Get more information and details over at Phoronix.com. Circus Ponies, check out Notebook. They have free trials. More information and details available at CircusPonies.com. Smile, check out Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, Text Expander Touch for iOS, and now PDF Pen for iPad. You can get information on all that stuff, as well as trials of their Mac applications over at smilesoftware.com. And check out Audible. You can get a free audiobook download, as well as try their Audible Listener Gold service for 14 days. You can get more information on that at audiblepodcast.com/MacCast. And check out Gazelle. Gazelle is a great place to get cash for your old electronics, that old iPhone, that old iPod. They make it quick and easy. Do a simple search, get a cash offer. You can get more information on that and details at gazelle.com. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. I do want to mention real quickly, I had an appearance. I'm terrible about following up on this stuff, but I was invited on the Church Tech Geeks podcast with Timothy Gregory a couple weeks ago. I went on there. I talked about the other part of my life outside of podcasting, web design and web development, and that was a lot of fun. If you want to check out that podcast, it's at thechurchtechgeeks.com. And you can take a listen to that and hear me talking about web design. But just wanted to mention that real quickly. If you have any feedback for me, any comments, any questions, anything you'd like to ask, anything to follow up on from this or any other episode, you can send me email to maccast@gmail.com. Or you can call in on our listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. You can leave voicemail there. You can also leave voicemail on Skype. My Skype address is the MacCast, and be sure to check out the MacCast.com website. There you will find show notes and links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast. And while you're there, be sure to check out the MacCast forum. That's at forum.maccast.com. If you'd like to follow me online between shows, you can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/themaccast, and like us, follow us there, do whatever you want. And with that, that's going to do it for this week. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.